What's up, everybody? Welcome back to University of Adversity. I'm your host, Lance Isios. This show is all about personal transformation. How do you show up in the face of adversity? My goal has always been to provide the best tools, tips, and resources for you to apply in your life when adversity hits, whether it's adversity that you're dealing with from the past, whether you're going through it now, or whether you're going to face it in the future. Which you will. I want to make sure you're ready. I've interviewed a lot of amazing people. People that either have their own inspirational story of overcoming adversity and going on to create an incredible life, or people who are experts in their field that can provide you with those resources that you can use. Today is no different. We have somebody that can provide you not only the inspiration, but also the tools. So you're in luck. Today's guest, we have Jeff Sorensen joining us. Now, as you can tell in the title of this episode, From Prison Hell to Spiritual Awakening and Liberation, this is a powerful episode. And I want you to know that this is one that you want to listen to right till the end. If you need to pause it halfway through, do what you need to do, but this is jam-packed with insight and tools for you to use when you're in the shit. And this man has been in the shit, and he has been able to alchemize this adversity, this pain, into his purpose and into his mission. And if you want to know how to do that, this is the episode you want to listen to. There's a lot of misconceptions about manifestation, all of that stuff. We get into how to manifest yourself out of a shitstorm and into a better life. If you want to know how to do that, you want to listen to this right till the end. You know, I'm obsessed with the human spirit. I love learning about people and how certain people make it out and certain people don't. And today, you know, this conversation with Jeff was one of those ones where I was just like, how did this guy get out of this? Like, how did you actually do that? And he's the real deal. You know, a lot of times you see these people on social media and they say one thing, but they don't embody the work. This guy embodies it. And I highly recommend following him, getting into his work, because he's the real deal. He's done it. He does the work every day, and he shows up with an open heart and that warrior spirit. So very inspirational episode. You're going to learn a lot. And yeah, I'm excited for you guys. And I'd love to hear your feedback on how this episode made you feel. And of course, if you guys aren't subscribed to the podcast yet, or you're new to the podcast, we are starting to pick episodes up again. We're going to be having more solo episodes. We got some great guest episodes coming up, but we're going to be picking things up again. So make sure you subscribe so you don't have to think about it. You automatically get the episode downloaded to whatever platform, whether it's Apple, Spotify, CastBox. You guys know the drill. And I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you taking the time. I know some of these episodes are a little bit longer, but they're worth it. And the tools that you're going to get and the perspective that you're going to get, I hope is going to really help shift the way you think, so that when adversity hits, you look at it and you are able to move through it a little bit better, a little bit more flow, and a little bit more ease. And just know that you got this. All right. Enjoy this episode with Jeff Sorensen.
Life is going to give you challenges, struggles. It's going to force you to face your fears. Even though these may feel like your worst enemy, in truth, these are actually your greatest allies. My name is Lance Isios. Welcome to the University of Adversity.
Jeff, welcome to University of Adversity podcast, brother. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Lance. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's good to have you. And I love being in your energy. You got a really great energy about you, even from last time we talked. We got on a call just for everybody. We got on a call, had a little bit of a chat, and I was just blown away by the stuff that first of all, what you're doing for the world now, but what you've been through. And I was like, okay, hold on. We gotta get you on the show. We gotta talk about this, because I think there's so much there's so much value in your story and also in what you're doing now. It's in alignment with myself. And I think something that so many people need, and I'm excited to kind of like weave through that whole journey. So I guess for me, like I like to start out with someone like yourself with, you know, growing up, and because a lot of the things that we have tend to start from there, a lot of the things, you know, and kind of weaves into our life. So what was childhood like for you? Maybe just give us a quick little walk through, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah, get right down to the roots here. Childhood, you know, is a lot of things, as it is for all of us. And I think for a lot of my life, I had a hard time looking past the traumas that I experienced. And there is a lot of challenging times in my childhood and a lot of challenging experiences that happened. And I think as I've gone through the healing process, I've been able to tease out some of the good things that happened and recognize that there was also a lot of really cool things that happened. And, you know, a lot of blessings that I received as well. And I think, you know, we can go through a time in our life where we can be really identified with the victimhood, and all we can see is the shadows. And looking back at my childhood, you know, I was always really studious. I loved to learn. You know, I'd go to the library and come home with a stack of books, you know, that tall, on everything that I could get my hands on. And I loved learning and going to school and just studying and researching. And so that's always been a big part of my life. I really kind of buried myself in school as a child. I started working at a really young age. I grew up to a family. I was born in Revelstoke, BC. Small mountain town, and we worked in forestry and we built log homes. So I worked from a really young age and developed a lot of skills at that age that have been really beneficial to have in my adulthood, and learned how to work and got to spend a lot of time in the bush and out in the mountains with no people around. So that was pretty cool. And yet there was a lot of challenges, and went through some pretty intense abuse of many different kinds throughout childhood. And so I hid my head in the books and just went through school and was just kind of at the top of my class. And, you know, there's a funny thing that happened, you know, as I got closer and closer to graduating high school, everybody would want to ask, you know, like, what are you going to do when you graduate? And, you know, and I just remember thinking in my mind, like, I really don't give a shit. Like, I just want to be happy, you know. And I spent a lot of my childhood really struggling mentally and just a lot of sadness and depression, whatever it was. And really, that was kind of like my primary focus, was I just want to be happy at some point. But I told the outside world that I wanted to be a doctor, and went off to school to be a neurosurgeon, was my goal at that time.
Wow. Why that?
I've always had a fascination with the brain. You know, I think even beyond that, just with consciousness, you know, in a funny way, I feel like what I'm learning now and what I'm teaching now fascinated me at a super young age. And, you know, without any real influences bringing that into my life, it was just something that I was super fascinated by. And even though I was a really good student, I would spend my lunch hours and my spare classes in the cafeteria talking to the kids that we called the skids, the ones that were doing psychedelics, and, you know, and learning about what their experiences were, and just this whole question of who are we, what are we doing, has always really interested me. And at that point, the brain seemed like the a pathway to understanding that more deeply. So
that's interesting, because it's kind of, you've kind of come to like a different part of your life where you're sort of learning the same sort of stuff in a different way. So it's almost come around like a full circle, right? That's yeah, really interesting, because even for like somebody young to want to study that, and even back then, you know, it wasn't like a very talked about thing. There wasn't all the resources that we have now, and like the podcasts and the doctors talking about neuroscience. So that's really interesting how you took interest in that and then ended up getting into the work you do today.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. It's just like I did become that, but just in a much different path than the one that I expected it to be.
Right. Yeah. So you were on the path to becoming a doctor. You wanted to do good in the world. You're fascinated with the mind, brain, why we're here. What happened after that? What took you, what kind of challenges did you face while going on that path?
Yeah, well, I'd left to go to university and landed in university in Vancouver. And I had started to open up to alcohol in high school. And as soon as that doorway was open, I just, you know, I rushed through the door and jumped on that train. And so when I got to university, you know, like I said earlier, even though I was super interested in neuroscience and studying and learning, I think at that point, there was so much inside me that was influencing the way that I was feeling, that it seemed so unimportant in some ways, you know, and it was like, I felt like I was struggling so much with my mental health that it seemed like, even though I wanted to become a neurosurgeon on some level, it just felt like there was so much in the way. And I felt like I had so much disdain towards authority. And the more that I drank, the more that, you know, these emotions and energy that I had inside just started to bubble up and really became apparent that, like, there's, you know, it felt like there's almost like a force living within that was kind of taking over my life at that point. And so I got, you know, I started out drinking, took the typical path, drinking. I did mushrooms, marijuana, you know, more psychedelics, ecstasy, cocaine. And I went to school for a couple of years. First year, kind of gave it a half-hearted attempt. Second year, I was just there to party. And at the end of the second year, I quit and went back to Revelstoke and started working in forestry. And it was really, you know, it was perfect timing in that I came back, you know, I had a good job and connected with a group of friends that were, you know, in that similar position of lots of childhood trauma, didn't want to look at any of it, just wanted to party. And so that all worked out perfectly, and just started down that path in life and still continued to work really hard. And, you know, it was fairly successful by what we would deem culturally to be successful through that period of my life.
It's a tough job you're doing, man. That's not an easy job. Like,
yeah,
it's one of the hardest things you could possibly do.
Like, it's really cool to look back at that. There's a lot of good memories through that time, and it's a pretty incredible opportunity to have.
For sure.
That time out in the wilderness where it is really remote, and even though, looking back, the work itself doesn't maybe morally align with where I'm at now, but to have the opportunity to be out in those really remote places was pretty special. Yeah.
What?
So I just go ahead.
No, keep going. I was going to ask you a question, but keep going on that thought.
Yeah. So really I just continued on that path of working and avoidance as much as I could, you know, not really wanting to acknowledge that that I had any part or any agency in what was continuing to bubble up in terms of instability and emotions and energetically and just becoming more and more unstable as time went on, but still trying to keep it all together, you know, and like present some kind of facade that I had my life together. And on the outside, it looked that way. And I was able to maintain that for a long time. But then I had some really severe accidents working out in the bush. And those were really doorways into a recognition that the reality that I believed to be true through that real scientific lens that I had been seeing life, it opened up the doorway to see that there was more going on than what I knew was going on. And I think on a really deep level, I found that even more unsettling and more ungrounding, you know. And so I had all this underlying instability anyways, and then those big accidents just started to crack things open on an even deeper level.
Did you start taking pain medication as well?
So I had an accident in my late 20s, and it was a really severe accident. And after that, that was when OxyContin was first making its debut in the world. And of course, it was a big hit, and it made its way over to the West Coast. And I was kind of in the first wave of that uptake within the medical system. And all of a sudden, everybody was taking OxyContin, and I was taking OxyContin, and I loved OxyContin. And I think I probably told you in our first conversation that I often tell people that the first couple of years of OxyContin were two of the best years of my life, because I didn't feel anything. And there was no pain, and, you know, no connection to emotions. And so that felt really good at that point. But then at some point that started to wear through, and the claws of addiction were really getting a deep hold on me, and that addiction just grew and grew. And with that background in recreational drug use, I was needing to use recreational drugs just to be able to keep myself functioning in the world and try and maintain this facade of personality that I was trying to bring to the world. And at some point that started to crack apart and become harder and harder to hold together. And I just went further and further down that path of addiction. And really at that point, you know, there's so much coverage and focus on the opioid addiction problem that we have right now, but that was really just the first wave of it. And so at that time, when I started to consider that, wow, you know, I really can't go on like this, and started to look around for support and treatment and different options, there was very, very few options. And I remember calling a clinic in Nanaimo that was a pretty well-known clinic at that point, and kind of the go-to place if you had real problems with addiction. And I called them, and literally the lady that I was talking to laughed at me on the phone. And she just said, you know, we don't have anything for you. You know, I'm sorry, but, you know, the amount that you're taking is so far beyond what we can treat, or, you know, the scope of the treatment programs that we have, that you're kind of on your own with that. And so I took it on my own. And at that point, I was also taking a bunch of other Western pharmaceuticals, SSRIs and anti-anxiety and different traditional pharmaceutical drugs. And so I decided to go off of all of the pharmaceuticals on January 1st, 2007. And that was a pretty rocky road. And I started to wean myself down off of the oxys, started doing a whole lot of recreational drugs to try and balance out. And And it was funny because I just, in the back of my mind, even though from the outside, like to everybody in my life, it looked like an absolute disaster. I kind of had a plan in the back of my mind of how this was all going to work out and how I was going to substitute one drug for another drug and eventually wean myself down and off. And eventually I did, but it was, as you know, a pretty wild story in between that point of first going off the pharmaceuticals to getting off all of the drugs.
Yeah. And when you said that, it like triggered our last conversation about the oxys. And I was like, oh yeah, of course. Cause we covered so much. And I was just like, I was so blown away by what you've been through that when you mentioned oxys, I was like, oh man, that is such a key time for so many people with getting addicted to that stuff. You know, after watching that painkiller Netflix documentary or whatever it was like a part series. And I was blown away by how that was even acceptable to push that kind of pharmaceutical onto humans and how that kind of stuff still goes on today in a certain capacity. And I can't even understand how irresponsible people could be. And then, you know, where you're in a position where you're taking all of these drugs and then you're basically fucked. Like you're hooked on this stuff with no resources. And it's like, here, figure it out. And it's so hard for me to understand. And it's so, I think back to even my own life and think about how easy it would have been for me to fall into that too, just to try it. Because a sports injury or something, someone says, it's fine. It's safe. You're putting your trust in the person that knows more about this than you, right? You're assuming, hey, this person, this is a doctor. This is a sports trainer. They're just telling me what they think is best. I should do this, you know? And then boom, you get stuck in this. And then it's like, well, now what? And you can't.
More drugs.
And you can only, there's that ceiling of like, it doesn't even affect you, right? And then that's where the street drugs come in. And it's so crazy to hear stories like this, bro. Like, and just, I can't even imagine like what you were going through, especially, you know, since like alcohol and these other drugs as well. Like, you know, a lot of people don't get out of that. Like a lot of people don't get out of that. And it's just, yeah, man, I'm just blown away by that whole, that whole point in time that shit was allowed. And it still is. I mean, let's be honest. We live in a really crazy world with this pharmaceutical stuff. But so, okay. You're at a point. Nobody was there to help. You're kind of stuck. Figure it out yourself. And then, you know, how did you start to like work through that? Like say somebody is struggling with something like that, like what was the thought process and what did you do? Like, how did you start to work through that?
I just had a plan in the back of my mind in terms of substituting methadone for OxyContin and how I was going to wean myself down off the methadone. And I was doing a lot of cocaine at the same time. And I never really liked cocaine. I did a lot of it, but it was something that I thought that if I could substitute along the way, that eventually I could get off of cocaine. And so I just went on that journey and really just started to shut people out of my life. Because there was a lot of people with a lot of opinions of what I should do. And like I said, from the outside, it didn't look very pretty. It wasn't very pretty on the inside either, but it was just what I felt like I needed to do. And I think I was just really tired of listening to people. And I just felt like I really needed to find myself and to start to learn to trust myself. And so, yeah, that was a many months long process to get myself weaned down off of the oxys and off of the methadone. And then I got right down to no oxys, no methadone, a lot of cocaine. And then I had another really serious accident and another near-death experience. And that really rocked me again at a whole another level. That actual experience, still when I look back at it, is just, it's so far beyond what we consider possible in the normal scope of reality in terms of what happened that day and in that accident, that I still can't make sense of it with my logical mind.
What happened?
But I was driving a vehicle, and I had been in this long process of trying. I felt like there was something wrong with my vehicle, and there's this funny thing that happens in life. Doesn't matter whether we're on drugs or not, but we're constantly influencing our reality. And so at that point, whether there was or not, I believed really strongly that there was something wrong with my truck. And I was on the highway one day, and there is some shady kind of things that happened, some really weird circumstances. I took off to head out of town, got onto the highway, kind of got up to highway speed. And it was kind of a suspicious accident. The back tire of my truck fell off, and I went off the side of the highway going about 140 kilometers an hour over a steep bank.
Wow.
And just kind of barrel rolled. It was a big black Ford Excursion. And so it's like so heavy and so big, and it was just plowing through the trees as I went down over the edge of the bank, and finally came to a stop as it crashed down into the ground. And I've still got a little scar on my shoulder from the seatbelt being on, and I blacked out and hit the ground really, really hard, woke up, and I was sitting up on the side of the bank, like 200 feet from the truck, just sitting there looking down at my truck. The driver's seat was completely squished, the roof was caved down right into the seat. The front of the vehicle was caved up right up to the seat. The door was caved in. I was in there when it hit the ground, and there I was sitting on the side of the bank. So pretty wild.
So what did your, like, were you okay? Like, what was your state?
I got 400 stitches in my left leg, had a broken heel, a broken ribs. My skull was fractured. And yeah, I walked up to the top of the bank and got to the top of the bank. This is kind of, it's an interesting part of the story. I still look back and feel that accident was suspicious, and the people I was suspicious of drove up and
really
saw me walk up to the top of the bank and offered to take me to the hospital. I chose not to go with them and waited for an ambulance. Got taken to the hospital. They wanted to keep me in the hospital, and I didn't want to stay. So I got out of the hospital and hitchhiked a ride back to Revelstoke in that state, and got back to the house that I was living in, and basically locked myself in that house with my dog, and didn't really leave a lot for the next few months. I pretty much stayed there. I went back on to oxys for a time, was doing a lot of drugs, would have drugs delivered to my house or leave to go get them, go back to the house. And basically at that point, I didn't have a vehicle. I really wanted to get far, far away. And at that time, for some reason, I had Honduras in my mind. That's where I wanted to go. I'd done a lot of traveling prior to and during all the drug use and at a young age. And so I just thought, I need to get far, far away from here. And yet it felt at that point so deep into addiction, I just couldn't quite put the pieces together. Like, how do I get a vehicle? How do I get out of here? How do I take my dog with me? My dog was kind of like the only thing keeping me together at that point. And so pretty much I was locked in that house doing drugs for about the next 6 months. Eventually I kind of started getting out more and more, and I was spending a lot of time in Vancouver at that time, and I was kind of renting vehicles, trying to get down to Vancouver, trying to figure out how to get a vehicle so that I could take off. Spent a lot of time on the downtown east side and going back and forth between there and Revelstoke. And finally I found somebody that would give me a loan on a vehicle. And so I went down to Vancouver, picked it up, and drove back to Revelstoke, grabbed some things, had my dog in the back of the seat, and took off across Canada at that point.
Dude, like, that part of the story is like crazy. So, okay, I want to transition a little bit into your, because I want to make sure that we cover all, like, you got, I mean, your story is like, I mean, you could have five podcast episodes to cover it, but okay. So what came up last time is like, we started talking about Mexico and started talking about these, you know, coming down this way where I'm at. Because you're, you know, where you currently are in Dominican Republic. Talk us about that journey. What led you down there and how you ended up in Mexico and what you got involved in? Because, you know, I feel like when we talk about, like, when you told me about what you had been through and how you were able to do what you do today, I was just, I'm still blown away by it. And I think it's just so fascinating. Like, the pain that you can endure and come out to be like one of the calmest guys I've ever talked to. Like, you're like one of the most chill dudes. And with all the shit that you've been through, it's like, it's why this show exists. So like, I walk us through that period of like, how did you end up down south? So you were, you know, you were kind of addicted to drugs. What led you down south to Mexico? What led you down to doing that crazy shit?
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll kind of skip over a big piece because there's, you know, there's a lot of side story in between Revelstoke and Mexico, and people have to check out the book for that part.
Yeah.
When it comes out, it's there's some juicy stuff there, but we'll just kind of fast forward. I left Revelstoke, had a wild journey down through the US, finally made it down to Mexico. And
so you drove down there?
I drove down.
Okay. Yeah. That must have been wild in itself.
Dude. Let's just say I finally got myself into the US and I got a speeding ticket in every state in between Minnesota and Ohio on my way to go visit a woman in Ohio. When I finally reached Ohio, the last cop pulled me over. He said, "Mr. Sorensen, you finally made it." Anyways, that's a long story, the Ohio bit. Eventually I left Ohio, made my way down to Mazatlan. Basically, if you look at the map and draw a straight line from Ohio to somewhere on the beach in Mexico, you end up in Mazatlan. And so I took off. I headed down to Mazatlan. I bought a fifth wheel trailer along the way. And so I pulled that down and then pulled into an RV park, parked my trailer in the RV park. It was the middle of summertime, so it was pretty quiet there. There's, you know, these big, big RV parks built for snowbirds, and there's nobody there that time of year. There's like a couple trailers that people left there year round. And there was one trailer with people in it, and it was a trailer owned by the Sinaloa cartel. And so I drove in and parked next to this trailer and got to know the guy who was doing the mule runs for the cartel at that point. And we were partying a lot together when I first got there, and got to know the guy that owned the trailer and also just wanted to stay out of trouble. So eventually And the guy that I met that I was partying with, he just kind of got lost in action, never came back. I got myself clean. There was a couple that drove through the RV park and spent a night, and they had a little VW van, and they're a young couple from California on their way to Costa Rica. And my friend and I were sitting outside, and we were still awake from the night before. And the girl got up one morning and got out of the van, and she asked us if we wanted to go to yoga with her. And I said, yes. And so I went to this yoga class, and, you know, I was there and been up all night partying for who knows how many days. And that started to become my lifeline. And I continued to party for another couple of months. But after about 2-3 months of really hardcore partying, but doing yoga, you know, 5 days a week, eventually I got to a point doing drugs where I realized that things were not going to end well. And I just dove into that practice of yoga and meditation and pranayama, and quit doing cocaine in the end, and all of the other drugs that I was on. As you know, still smoking marijuana at that point, but just kind of weaned myself down off of that and got clean and became a yogi, and then opened a restaurant in Mazatlan and started teaching yoga, you know, about a year after I started practicing. And had a really beautiful opportunity to land in my hands to teach. And I didn't really want to, but my teacher really wanted me to. And so I agreed to do that. And I started teaching, and I had the restaurant and was working my butt off at the restaurant and just doing my best to stay out of trouble, And I was working and working and working, and I just couldn't kind of get my feet back underneath me, you know. And I burned through so much money on my way down and through all the partying that slowly I just started to bleed out, and I just couldn't support myself in the way that I wanted to, and eventually ran out of money. I think it was my third year in the restaurant, and I got to the end of a high season, and it's, you know, a few months of a really low season in between, and I didn't have enough money to pay my rent at the restaurant and pay the rent at the house that I was renting. And so I'd been staying in touch with this guy who owned the trailer, who worked for the cartel. And at that point, I just didn't really feel like I had a lot of options in terms of what I was going to do. And so I started to go to work for him, and we started to transport drugs up to the border within Mexico. And I did that on and off for a couple of years, and then finally got to the point where I quit. And, you know, it was like, okay, I think I'm good. And I just, you know, again, tried to step away from it, did a yoga teacher training. And I came back to Canada actually to visit my family. And interestingly, I bought a ticket into Calgary and a ticket out of Victoria. And I started in Calgary, and I started to visit all of my good friends, all of my family in between Calgary and Victoria. And I was at a dinner party that some friends had thrown in Calgary. And I remember sitting on a couch and saying to my friend, you know, I have the weirdest feeling that I'm not going to see any of you for a long time. And it kept going on that trip, visited all my family, all my friends, flew back out of Victoria, back down to Mexico, landed there and got into the season, opened the restaurant, started teaching yoga. And it was just like something just didn't feel quite right. And I just had this strange feeling that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, but I couldn't figure out how to change anything. And so I kept just moving forward, and restaurant was doing okay at that point. And, you know, I'd had enough money to invest in it that it was kind of holding its own at that point. And I was at the restaurant one night. A guy came into the restaurant, sat down, had dinner, called me over after dinner, And I sat down and he said, you know, the food that I had here tonight was some of the best food I've had anywhere in the world. I was at the party that you catered a few nights ago. You know, he said, I'm just blown away at the quality of your food. And, you know, at this point I'm in my life, I'm retired, but I'm an angel investor. And so I love to invest in people's businesses. And I'd love to invest in your business if you'd like to expand and grow your business and franchise. And so I thought, wow, like this is incredible. And so I'm literally sitting there listening to this guy and we're talking back and forth and I'm looking down the road and I see my friend who works for the cartel driving up. And so I tell this guy that I'm talking to, I say, yeah, this is all great. I just got to run over here and talk to my friend here for a few minutes. So I'll be right back. And of course, it's my friend Gabrielle, and he wants me to go do one more run. And so, you know, at first I say no. And then he offered to pay double. And I still said no. And then finally we talked back and forth and back and forth. And finally, it's just kind of like, yeah, you know, I'll think about it and we'll talk tomorrow or whatever. And I go back, sit down, talk to this guy who wants to invest in the restaurant. And, you know, we come up with all these plans. And then next day I wake up and Gabrielle calls. I say no. And then I was in my head about it and I was going back and forth. And I picked back up the phone and I said, okay, let's go. And so I went on that trip and that was a setup. And yeah, I got busted and went to jail in Mexicali for 2 years. And yeah, I took all my yoga practice and meditation practice and breathwork practice with me, and definitely needed all those tools to get through that experience.
Okay. All right. Let's just put a pin there for one sec. Okay. Okay. So this is so interesting. Now, like knowing what you know, you had these feelings, you had these two doorways to pick. You knew one didn't feel good, and you probably knew the outcome. You had another one where you have this opportunity to expand what you love, what you're doing. You're doing all this yoga. You have these like two identities, right? It's like these two things. And it's just it like the way you articulated that, I could resonate, and I'm sure a lot of people can too, how there's like you have that opportunity to choose one. And like, why do you think you decided to choose that when like you probably knew the outcome? Like if you've watched any drug movies, like Blow, I'm sure you've watched like all these, it's like that last one is always the one. Like, why do you think, like, what was the reason? And I think this is really important, is like, because people get stuck in these conflicts, these conflicted things, right? Like these, and I've been through it too. It's like going back into that world or like choosing a different one. It's like you get these opportunities that come and it's like your chance to choose. And if you don't choose that one, then you got to deal with the consequences, but then you'll get another chance to choose again. And it's just so fascinating that you were in that position and you chose that. Like, why? What do you think now after understanding the journey? Like, and if somebody is in that position, like, how did you, like, what was the process of feeling into it? Especially being with yoga and knowing your intuition and your body, like, why did you choose that? What do you think I'm just so blown away by this.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating point that you bring up, you know, how we get to these moments and why we make these decisions, and even knowing the potential consequences and being able to feel that in our body, that that's likely where we're going, but we still choose that. And I think knowing at this point, what I know, I think we choose it because it's what we need to do for the learning that we've come here to do in our life. And so at that point, on a very superficial level, what I was feeling was it was like, okay, you know, if I get paid double for this run, then it's like the restaurant's kind of on its own feet right now. That would give me enough money to get myself back to Canada, get myself set up in the summertime, rent an apartment, buy a car, get a job up there in the summertime, and be able to go back and forth and kind of get myself out of what really felt to be like, I really felt like I was stuck in Mexico. You know, I had these two dogs. One of them was too big to put on an airplane, so I couldn't fly her back to Canada. You know, I couldn't drive back through the US. And so it just felt like I didn't really have that many options. And I had in the back of my mind that I would like to go back to Canada and just try and get my feet back on the ground there. And so, in the ego logical mind, it made sense. And yet at the soul level, there was definitely a recognition that something was going on and something was about to go down, and feel like it was all perfect. It was all exactly what I needed, because I'm so grateful to be where I am at right now. And I'm grateful for who I am. And I'm grateful for the things that I learned along the way. And I'm grateful that I got out of jail. And I'm grateful that I have those experiences to draw upon now, because they've made me who I am today. And even when I got to jail, I knew I was exactly where I needed to be. Like, I just had such a strong feeling, even though I didn't like it at all. There was a deep, deep knowing that it's like, this is exactly where I need to be right now. And that was a powerful support throughout that process, was to just recognize that I was where I needed to be. And that was a part of my path.
Okay. So it's so fascinating, man, about that whole situation. So you get to jail, the door is closed. Like, what was going through your mind when you got there? Because everybody has that like fear. It's like the worst fear coming true, right? Like, you hear about it. Oh man, you don't want to end up in like some Mexican prison or some fucking prison in Colombia, right? It's like, so you realize you're going in, what was the feeling? And then like, walk us through, cause I like what you were telling me about, like just what you had to endure and how you used your tools. This is the thing that is, I really want people to understand, is like, this is why the work, this is why the tools are so important, right? Because like this, what you've been through really demonstrates the practical use of the tools itself. And walk us through that feeling. And like, maybe how, when you first got there, how did you deal with the craziness? And then, yeah, just speak to us about that and see how that unfolds. So I'm just really want the listeners to understand like that feeling of being there and actually having to say, you know what, I'm here, here's how I'm going to get through this.
Yeah, it felt rushing. You know, I felt like I had, regardless of what I was doing for work, I felt like I'd worked so hard to get myself back on my feet after addiction. And then to land there and just have it all just like flash in front of my eyes. And it's like, you know, like, fuck. And, you know, I think about the four stages of grief, you know, and like the first stage being denial. And it's kind of like there's just a coping mechanism that you use, and you're in denial that you're going to be there in the very beginning. It's like, well, maybe I could get out. Maybe I could, you know, I was thinking about a lot about like trying to break my way out to, you know, the whole process of actually getting to the final jail. It's like looking, like thinking like, should I take off? Can I get out of here? And then eventually getting to a point, I remember sitting with my lawyer in, you know, in the space where we'd connect there, and him saying that the sentence was 10 to 25 years. And I laughed at him, and he's like, no, for real, like the sentence is 10 to 25 years. And I was just like, oh my God. And You know, and of course he says, oh, you know, but don't worry about that. We'll get you out in a few months. And then a few months turns into 6 months and 6 months turns into a year. And that's just kind of a game that they play down there. Finally, I landed in the cell where I spent most of the 2 years. And it's, you know, it's almost unimaginable. You can't, even for me, having been there, it's hard for me to imagine what it was like because it was so far outside of what our brain can even really conceive. You know, there's 30 people living in an 11 foot by 11 foot room and living in there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, except for an hour a week to get out and go outside. And so the first thing that I did when I got there pretty much was figure out like, where can I do yoga? Because I knew that I needed to do yoga. I needed to meditate. I needed to do breath work if I was going to have any hope of getting out of there. And what it really felt like to me was like a final exam in manifestation. And I'd been learning about the workings of the mind and, you know, the intricacies of reality and manifestation. And it, you know, the voice that kept coming to my head was, it's like, okay, can you manifest your way out of here? And, you know, it being like the most challenging circumstances that one could find themselves in to try and manifest. And I knew that the first step in that process was I needed to be okay with where I was at. And that process took about a year to really be okay being there. And, you know, I figured out very quickly that there is a spot right beside the bathroom and people slept on the floor. People slept on a platform welded on the top level of bunks. There's a few bunks in the room as well. And I realized that if I just slept in that place that was right beside the bathroom and I didn't move away from the bathroom, it's kind of like the progression. You get into the cell, you sleep right next to the bathroom because nobody wants to sleep there. And then you move away from the bathroom the more time you have there. And I thought, well, if I just stay right there, then I can practice yoga and I can meditate every day after the food came and people go back to sleep. And so, you know, I would have a couple hours of a pretty undisturbed time where I would do my practice. And then the rest of the time, basically, it was just like doing all the things that you read about in all the books about manifestation. It's interestingly, when I first got there, I got my hands on a copy of El Secreto, The Secret, which was, you know, a big book at that time. And also in English, I got a copy of Deepak Chopra's The Way of the Wizard. And so those really became my Bibles. And yeah, I just was doing all the affirmations, the journaling, the speaking, the reality that I wanted to see. And it was just like every possible resistance and, you know, and just like shadow of that, you know, attacking it at all times, you know, like it's like nobody in jail wants to see anybody else happy, you know, or, and it's just like, it's so satisfying to like try and put other people down and just watch other people being crushed by the weight of being in there and the despair of, you know, not being able to get out. And I was just really, really focused on freedom. And so that's what I spent all my days thinking about, talking about, drinking, eating. I just, everything I did was about freedom.
Okay. Put us in when you were dialed into your practice. Like if somebody is stuck in a situation that is not ideal and they want to get out, like let's say most people aren't in jail doing this, but this is why this is so fucking fascinating to me, to the fact that you could apply this and be that frequency in the worst case imaginable, in the worst spot imaginable. Like anybody can be all spiritual and woo woo in when everything's going well. But how do you show up in the face of adversity? How do you show up in the shit? That's how you define somebody, right? Like that's, I fully believe that. I'm like, how do you show up when things aren't perfect? And how do you show up when things are really, really bad? Like yours, like that is just, it's hard for me to even want to think about it because it makes me sick to my stomach thinking about what you went through, where there's like a hole in the ground for shitting. There's no bathroom. Like you're in the worst thing possible. And I just like, part of me wants to fucking cry that you had to go through that because it's so awful. But part of me is like, holy shit, man. Like what a story, how you're able to do this. So like, I would love to just know, like for people that are confused about manifesting, like, let's say they're in a tough position. They're stuck in their head, their body, whatever. What would you say? What was your process to like, from when you wake up, what did you do? What did you think about? What did you write? Walk us through that if you could, as like, kind of like your manifestation formula out of hell. Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, it looks like getting really disciplined, and that's what I was when I was there, you know. And it was fascinating to the other inmates, as much as they, you know, a lot of them hated it on some level, was to watch me go through my days. And you know, I would get up in the morning and I would drink some water, and then I had a scrap of a blanket that I found in this first cell that I was in when I was in solitary confinement. And I would lay that down on the floor where I'd been sleeping. And I had some cardboard boxes that I would put underneath that to soak up all the water on the ground. And it's like a mat that's, you know, like probably 14 inches wide. And I would sit down on that mat and I would meditate, and I would pray, and I would do some breath work, and I would focus my mind, and I would try and visualize what it was going to be like to get out of there, which was
in what
one
detail,
of the hardest.
Like what were you imagining?
You know, what was bizarre is after I'd been there for probably about 15 months, a magazine came through the cell that had a picture in the back of the photographer who had taken pictures for the magazine. And he was standing in a spot in Mazatlan where I walked my dogs every day.
Wow.
And so I cut that picture out of the magazine, and I would look at that picture every day, because at that point, when you're in jail and that becomes your reality, it's almost impossible to visualize anything outside of that. Like you start to forget your memories of what outside looks like. And so I got that picture, which was just gold, right? And I could see, you know, this vista that I could feel in my own body. And I would just close my eyes and I would just feel myself being there. And oof. It's intense even to feel back into those moments and think about like how intense that was. And, you know, really at that time, it was just, you know, it's, I have such a strong drive, and just, if somebody tells me I can't do something, I just want to do it that much more, you know. And it was like, everybody in there, you know, like I was the only white person in prison, and there's just a level of racism, you know, like conscious, unconscious, but it is like, you know, picking on the Canadian guy and trying to make this Canadian guy, this gringo that's, you know, into yoga and doing his stupid meditation, like trying to attack that was like a favorite pastime of many of my fellow inmates there. And so it just, it's like I kind of thrive in that intensity. And it was like, you know, like the more that I was attacked, the more that people would tell me that it wasn't going to happen, the more I was just committed that it was going to happen, and it didn't matter what. And eventually it did. It was pretty miraculous the way that it unfolded.
So you would visualize the picture And would you say I am free? Would you write it down? And what did that?
I would literally, like, that was my mantra. And I would think that all day, you know, the ego mind would come in, start telling stories, and I would just come back to that mantra of, I am free. Thinking freedom. I'm leaving here, and just imagining what it was going to be like to walk out the door and not come back. I'd literally, like, when I would drink, I would, like, drink freedom. I would eat freedom. You know, I would journal about freedom. I would talk about freedom. And it was just in everything I did. When I did my yoga practice, it was like every movement was, you know, was with that mantra. You know, I was using it in meditation. I was focusing on that thing that I wanted. And, you know, and interestingly, it's interesting to look back, because it was almost like it was easier to manifest there because of the high stakes than anywhere else that I've ever tried, because it seemed so important. Whereas in life, we can get distracted by a lot of things, and life can be pretty good. And that pretty good, or that comfort, can kind of distract us from what is that thing that I really want. Whereas there was just one thing that I wanted, and that was to get the heck out of there.
That's a great point. Yeah, we get stuck in that, like, middle zone where it's like just good enough, just enough dopamine. It's okay. And it almost takes you to hit that point where it's like almost like your back is against the wall, like the ships are burned, like there's no other option.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and that's a powerful space to be at, where you got to create money, you got to create clients. And it's amazing what we can do when we're like we're in a position like that. Hopefully people don't have to be in jail to realize that, but like, that's such a good point, is that like, can you do that when you're in the mundane and things are just good enough?
Mm-hmm.
Can you remember?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I've struggled with that in the time since, is that I find it challenging to focus on the one thing, you know. And they say that we think 99% of the same thoughts today that we thought yesterday. And it's, you know, at that point, you know, it was just freedom, you know. But now it's like, there's just so many distractions, so many options, that to really try and hone it in, I think that's like the superpower of our time, is to really be able to focus and really be able to come up with one pointed focus of how we want to move forward. What do we want to focus our time and energy on? And yeah, it's a big challenge for a lot of people, including myself.
Yeah. I mean, me too. And this is why it's so interesting, because I think a lot of people are struggling with this too. And I think that that's such a good point. And it's like, your actions have to align, and you have to fully embody what you're thinking and feeling in aligned action. And it's hard because there's distractions. We pick up our phone and then somebody makes us think something differently, or like somebody outside speaks negative, and we just, it's really, you're right, it's such a superpower to be able to do that. And yeah, it's such a fascinating topic. This is where I wanted to go with you about this. Was like, now when you look at your life, like, how do you balance between your ego and like getting attached to like the thing you want to create, but versus like maybe it's not, maybe that thing isn't even what you're supposed to have, but it feels like you're not manifesting it, or it's not coming. But really, that thing isn't supposed to. Like, how do you have it release attachment to, like, especially as entrepreneurs and building businesses, it's like, got to have this, and it's got to end up like this. And if it doesn't, you're a failure. If it doesn't, you know what I mean? Like, how do you dance with that, as far as like, you kind of got what you wanted in that manifestation. You have freedom. You're creating this. Like, how do you let go, and how do you become unattached to things, but still have a purpose and still, you know, move forward. And if things don't come to fruition exactly as planned, like, how do you navigate that? Like, with the everyday life?
Yeah, I think there's a big piece in there around the recognition that everything is and always is perfect, and seeing that life is a continually unfolding learning process. And so there is no right and wrong, you know, and there is no mistakes, you know, we're just in this process of learning. I think my idea of what manifestation is has changed a lot, or the way in which I manifest. And this is an ongoing experiment, so I don't really know, you know, what, you know, there, again, there is no right and wrong way, but I see manifestation a lot less about getting what I want now, as opposed to manifesting the true potential and truth of who I am, and the true divinity, the spiritual underlying spiritual nature, and allowing that to manifest through me, as opposed to what I see a lot in manifestation is ego desires, you know, and focusing energy and attention on the desires of the ego, which is, of course, just trying to keep us safe. And so all of our desires are based around trying to create security and comfort and avoid any type of pain. And now I don't see it so much like that. And I don't feel like that aspect of life is as important to me as I think for me, the most important thing is to realize my true potential. And I feel I have a belief system that collectively we're in a time of recognizing who we truly are, and that we're not human, this small self, you know, poor me kind of victim that, you know, has no choices in life and gets dealt a certain hand. It's like there's a deeper recognition emerging that we have so much more potential than we have ever realized. And so I think for me, that is the most important thing to manifest, is that potential, and to release the blockages, to release the constructs and the beliefs, the limiting beliefs that I impose upon myself, the ways that I choose my reality, the things that I choose to experience in my reality. And so I focus more of my energy on that than manifesting specific things.
Yeah, I've started doing that as well, about instead of specifics being like calling in synchronicities and opportunities and people that align with my highest potential for myself and for all, and releasing like it has to be this way. It's like, just let me call in the people. Let me call in the highest people for the highest good, the highest synchronicities, the opportunities, and then being in receiver mode to see them and receive them when they're there. Because it's so easy to be like, no, it has to be this person, this way. Okay. Otherwise, it's not the thing.
Yeah.
Right. It's so easy to like have this perception of like, okay, show me the right thing. No, that's not the right thing. That's not the right thing. That's not the right thing. And you miss out. So it's like that feeling of like being willing to like be open and ready to receive, because it's never, miracles happen in the unknown too. Like
absolutely. Yeah, I always say that our small mind can never possibly conceive, you know, the magnificence of what could unfold in our life if we can step back and allow that to unfold through us. And yet there's a continual desire to kind of migrate back towards that sense of safety, you know, the sense of being satisfied, of getting what we think we want. And it's, I think that's the battle, is to recognize that for what it is, and continually recognize the ego when it's active and be choosing to live differently and live outside that, live beyond it.
Speak to us a little bit about your breath work and kind of like now what you're doing as far as using that in your life and offering this to people. Walk us through a little bit of that, what you're working on, because we're aligned like that too. I just finished doing my 9-month trauma-informed breathwork facilitator training, which feels amazing. And I just, you know, personally from doing my own practices have seen what it's done for me. And I'm like, wow, okay. Because I think you have to embody it first to see it in yourself before you offer it and teach it to people. And I feel like that's what you do and that's what you've done. And I'm curious to kind of like walk us through a little bit about that and, you know, kind of let people in on like what it is you're up to, because it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, even just to rewind and give the super cool notes, you know, I got out, I ended up back in Canada, started working as a paramedic, and, you know, really just dove into my personal practice again. And, you know, as much as I wanted to teach, recognized that I needed to get my feet back on the ground. So I worked as a paramedic and worked in construction, and again, just kind of worked my butt off for a few years, and then got to a point where a lot of things had unfolded really well for me. And I realized that there was an opportunity to start to step away from kind of being in the system again. And I had had a lot of experience with pranayama and was, you know, really deep into that practice. I had had some conscious connected breathing experiences, and that had been really profound as part of my yoga teacher trainings. And yet it hadn't quite grabbed me. I was working as a paramedic on Galliano Island, and I came across podcasts, Tim Ferriss and Wim Hof, and listened to that podcast, which maybe you've listened to and maybe
Classic.
Some of your viewers have as well.
Classic game changer.
Yeah, it really was. And I was just really struck by the conviction that he had and just the energy that he was bringing to that conversation. And I was at a point where I was really struggling with chronic sinus infections, and I was doing pretty good in the world, but I was just kind of dealing with this recurring thing that was really bringing me down. And it was springtime on Galliano Island. It's just like a big like pollen forest, and so I was just dying. And I was like, I'll do anything to like get rid of these sinus infections. And so I started doing the Wim Hof breath work, and I started going in the ocean every day, and it was just like a next level up. And I thought, okay, you know, like yoga wasn't quite feeling like the thing that I wanted to focus on. And, you know, I was starting to see breath work emerge more as a modality. And I thought, okay, I want to learn everything I can about breathing. And so it was a couple of months after that, I had signed up to do the Wim Hof training, and signed up to do another conscious connected breath training and do some other trainings. And I was sitting in ceremony with ayahuasca, and the idea of Breath Army just kind of fell into my lap in ceremony. I didn't really know what it was at that point. I still don't know if I really know what it is, but I feel like the last like 6 years have been kind of trying to figure out, well, what is this thing? What does this thing want to be? And I traveled around the world, and I did a bunch of trainings and learned everything I could from all the best people that I could find. And then really saw that there was what felt to me to be a real gap in the breathwork world, and a lack of kind of integration of all of the different modalities of breathwork. And it was kind of like there's like Buteyko breathing and oxygen advantage on one side, and Wim Hof breathing and conscious connected breathing, and then pranayama was somewhere mixed in there, but it was like there was no real connection between any of them. And that really bothered me, and that research kind of like really studious mind, it's like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Like, there's got to be like some common threads. And I wanted to really unravel those and figure out what was going on a deeper level and a physiological level. And and when, you know, when to use a particular practice over a different practice and what they were actually doing in the body. And so that's when I started to weave all those pieces together and to see an opportunity to share the work in a little bit different way than had been shared up until that point. And it seemed it was an interesting emergence that I could see happening in different places. Different people were kind of picking up on that same thing at the same time. And so that's really how I started sharing in the world. And I started doing workshops and started traveling around BC and, you know, doing the breathwork workshops, cold exposure workshops. And then during the pandemic, I started an online course that was really popular and successful. And then I started doing retreats. And then, you know, eventually people started asking, you know, when are you going to start to train people? And I kind of resisted that for a long time and eventually gave into that. And here we are.
Man, it's awesome. Yeah. And I feel like we're just scratching the surface with breath and what it can do, right? Because the science hasn't really caught up, like, to the level that, you know, some people would want, right? Like, but it's like, there's something so magical that happens, like, you know?
The thing I love about breath work is that there is enough science to be able to communicate with people. And for people to understand on a physiological level,
yeah,
what's going on in the body.
Right.
And that provides an entryway to be able to communicate with people on a level that they can understand. And yet there's so much more, like you alluded to, that's going on that we have no idea what's going on. But it's just enough to get people in the door,
yeah,
with something that they can kind of hold on to. And it's like, okay, yeah, I could try this thing because it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And then it gets them in the door. And it doesn't matter what they think after that point because it's experiential.
Yeah.
And they're experiencing it in their body. And as a result of their own direct experience, there's a recognition that's like, wow, there's something really deep and profound going on here that I don't necessarily even need to understand, but most people want to experience more of that.
That's such a good way to put it. Yeah. I mean, sometimes that's all you need, right? To understand what's happening, sympathetic, parasympathetic, what kind of, you know, get you to that state. And it's like, what happens in your life will be evidence to what shows up. Like, and then you combine that with a meditation practice. That's what I do. I mean, I found the most powerful for me is like, do that. And then I'll do like a deep Dr. Joe Dispenza meditation, like one of his advanced ones. And man, like, and I like to switch up meditations too, but I love the combination of that, you know, get yourself to that level. And then it's like, then do meditation. And, you know, for me, my day is just like, I just feel connected to myself. Isn't that really the point?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's so powerful. And I think it really, in an incredible way, really does open us up to see a glimmer of what our true potential is. And yeah, I do the same thing. I combine my breath work with meditation afterwards. And I think that's also an important piece from a physiological perspective as well, to just balance things out and regulate the breathing after a deep experience like that. But as you said, the energetic that we access through the deep breathing and then to carry that on and go into those realms, it's, you know, the potential and possibilities are endless. And I think we're really just scratching the surface of what's possible.
Yeah. And that's the beautiful thing too. It's like, for everybody that does it, it's going to be a different experience, right? It's going to pull up different things. Sometimes what you think you're going to work on will not be the case. And sometimes you'll, you know, look at stuff and you're like, oh, I didn't even think about that. For me, like I have found since starting breathwork a few years ago, practicing it, I say for me, this has been the most powerful is like developing that deeper connection to my intuition, like insights. Like I don't see visually, I don't see things very, very often. I'll see like kind of subtle things, but it's that like inner knowing, it's that inner guidance. It's like, oh, that thing just came up. I'll get quotes. I'll get like the name of my book. Like, I'm like, that's the thing. Like, and you know, that's the truth. Like I believe that's the truth. And then that's, it's like, okay, that's the thing. I got to remember that. And then it doesn't even make sense sometimes, but it's like, okay, I got to explore that. I feel like what a gift to be able to have. Right. And it's like, you can get that in plant medicine. You can get that in a lot of stuff, but for me, that has been the most powerful. It's like having the access to your own pharmacy, your own breath, and to be able to like ask for something. And then, you know, sometimes you get the answer you need. And it's like, it's fascinating to me. And for me, that has been all of like the best insight for me has come through breath work. It's really, absolutely, really fascinating that what a gift that we have that in ourselves to use at any time, like just to breathe. Like
it's so wild and so powerful. And it's, you know, as you're speaking and, you know, the opportunity to be able to connect with our higher self, to use a modality that quietens down the part of the brain that's always just kind of ruminating and in the foreground and kind of in the way of that intuition dropping in, and to be able to have access to that and to be able to start to lean into that and have that guide us in our lives is just, as you said, it's such a blessing. And it takes so much of the pressure off of having to like think and like figure out all these things. It's like, no, it's just, it's right there, you know, and it becomes, you know, like instead of a struggle, it's like life becomes like this kind of like a treasure hunt. It's like this fun thing of, you know, using these different modalities to access these states, to access the information, to lead us on the next step on our path. And it becomes a whole lot more fun and a whole lot more magical.
Yeah. And I think these are things that we did for hundreds, thousands of years. And like, here we are in this small blimp in time where it's like, you know, the world that we're in, and it's like how this stuff isn't taught when we're like kids. And it's just, for whatever reason, this period of time is the period of time we chose to come. And it's like, to be able, I just say too, like sometimes I'm like, just to be aware enough to know, like to get out of that like matrix and under just the fact of being aware that there's like different things and it's not just this like program and just, you know, like it's like the awareness is like a gift. Like, it's such a blessing.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, as in everything I teach, the awareness is the foundation of everything. It's like without the awareness, and we don't really even know where we're starting from, but the awareness is that first step and that first brick in the foundation. And once we have that deeper awareness, then look out, because there's no going back.
Yeah. that feeling, like there's no going back. It's true, man. Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
And yeah.
Some days I'm like, man, I wish I wouldn't have known that. I wish I wouldn't have just seen that. I could have just, there's like days where I'm like, oh, I wish I was just like those other people just living. I mean, I don't, but you know, there's days where it gets heavy, man.
Oh, yeah.
Life brings some heavy stuff. And I really believe it takes a warrior to just face the daily mundane and the stuff that surfaces, right? And I think like having tools that can just help you in that moment to move through is like is everything. And I mean, that's what you do. And because I feel like those moments are such key moments in everyday life. Because it's you, it's like a challenge comes and immediately go distract yourself or go hide or go, right? And it's like, no, what if you can just be in it, feel it, move through it, right? It's like that those little moments every day are what really help, you know, define a person. And it's, but it's so easy to run away from those things. And I think what you do with tools like, you know, cold therapy and breath work and yoga, all this stuff is just like practical stuff that people can use on a daily basis to move through that stuff, you know?
Yeah, well, the reality is that everybody goes through it, you know, and we all go through it in our own way, and we've all got our own story, and we've all had, you know, these experiences that we've gone through. And yeah, there's just this tendency to avoid being in it, you know, and yet it's like when you get used to living in this way and confronting and being in the midst of whatever's arising, it's the best thing ever to work through those pieces as they come up. And I think, you know, after you get through a certain point that I call the heavy lifting that happens in the beginning of the process, and you get a little bit further down the path, you get to a point where even though things can be deeply, deeply challenging, it's kind of like you're looking forward to it because it's peeling back another layer of unreality that's on top and kind of clouding our vision of who we really are. And it's like, yeah, just, I want to get rid of that and really dive in and feel into who am I really and what am I capable of, and whatever needs to come up. It's like, well, yeah, bring it on and let's see what's there, because I want to move through it.
Yeah, because you know what's on the other side of that is always a bliss, or it's always a treasure of some sort.
Yeah.
I found, like, even with when I did ayahuasca, it really landed for me about fear. It was like I remember my last night, and it was like, you know that thing, you know, fear, it's actually like an invitation to ask you, do you want the treasures of life? Do you love that feeling of fulfillment? Yeah, well, then this is the invitation. That feeling of fear, or that feeling of like, oh, this sucks, that's the invitation. Because on the other side of that is you're gonna get what you want. Like, you're gonna have that that feeling, because that's the you know, the opposite. And it was like, when that, you know, that's easy to say sometimes. Like, I don't always like lean into my fears like I should, but that has always stuck with me. It's like, oh, you say you want fulfillment, you say you want that. Well, the thing that's asking you to meet it is going to give you that. It's that, it's like a dance, right? It's an invitation, like, hey, I'm here, just get over this and you're going to get the thing. And I feel like that was a big thing that stuck with me, of like, there's a reason those like things pop up in life. It's like, oh, why am I scared of that? Interest, like, what, there's got to be something on the other side of that.
Absolutely. I like the way that you put that. You know, and I like to think about fear as one of our greatest teachers. And it's like you said, we're always in this dance of it presenting ourselves anytime that we're on the path to something greater, something bigger. And it's to recognize it for what it is, and to be able to move beyond it. And as you said, to be able to realize that everything that we want is on the other side of that, and that there's no getting around it. We need to go just directly through it, and to be able to see and have that commitment and conviction and dedication to be in it and to get through it and get to the other side and get to what we all deserve, you know, which is to live and to feel that joy and feel bliss and to have connection with other amazing people. And, you know, like, life is such an incredible experience if we choose it, you know, and we're constantly choosing, what reality do I want to be in? And, you know, I think that you're very, very conscious and aware of that. And I think hopefully many of the people that are listening are as well. And it's something that I continually need to remind myself of, is that I'm choosing. And so if I'm choosing to experience something that I don't like, then I need to make different choices, and that will lead to a different outcome. And yeah, we keep that awareness piece that you mentioned earlier is is kind of the linchpin to all of that, is just having that awareness and being conscious in all of the decisions that we're constantly making.
Yeah, and I think to kind of like tie up that law of attraction and manifesting is like, I think a lot of people get a lot of the Abraham Hicks work mixed up in a certain way. But my take is it kind of like what you were alluding to earlier is just like, you're going to get the shitty situation, but to manifest, you have to choose the most empowering thought and the most empowering feeling. You have that opportunity in each situation, right? And it doesn't mean that it's warm and fuzzy and fluffy. That's not what it is. It's not like, this is what people don't understand. I feel like it's all about what you're in, what choice, what thought are you going to feed? Disempowering thought, empowering thought. What's it going to feel like on the other side of this thing? That's the focus that I've realized, because I used to get stuck in this, like, how does law of attraction work with when she's talking about this stuff, and how does it make sense in real life? And like, you bringing that up today was like another way to solidify it for me. And I think people, this is a big thing for people to understand, and like a lot of people have confusion about it. But, and I want to just, you know, kind of hear your thoughts before we kind of wrap things up. It's like, the situation is presented. You can either choose empowering thought, empowering feeling to move through it, what's on the other side, or you focus on the problem, the solution, the disempowerment. Like, would you say that's like the simplest way? Like, as, and that's what her teachings, that's what law of attraction was really, but it gets all mixed up. And it's like, people think it has to be this like, oh, if you're grinding, you can't have law of attraction or whatever, but we're all going to be felt. We're all going to be dealt these situations, and to break it down, like, that's how you do it. Would you say, like, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think you're right on the money. And I think if anything, just to maybe say the same thing in different words, is to recognize that every situation that's unfolding is unfolding in support of whatever we're calling into our lives. And the thing that gets in the way is our small mind thinking that it knows the path and it knows the way that things should unfold. And so we get in our own way when these challenging experiences unfold. And we need to recognize them for what they are, which is teachings and an opportunity to learn and to grow and to expand on that path, and to recognize that they're all happening for us, and that in any situation, it doesn't matter what situation that we're in, that the highest choice that we can choose is to love it. And to accept it fully, to welcome it, to love it, and to recognize that it's happening for our benefit and it's leading us on the path to where we want to go.
Well said. Oh, all right, we went way over here, bro. So I'm like, hey, we might be an hour. Let's wrap this up though. And where can people, what are you working on? Where can people find you? You got your book. Did you say that's out now, or is that you working on that?
So work on progress. We got 45,000 words written right now and long ways to go on that. And yeah, thank you for your inspiration and the call that we had a couple of weeks ago that helped me to dive in deeper and continue on that path. So working on that. Working on a new course, which I'm pretty excited about, which will replace the breathwork blueprint that's kind of been a big focus of mine over the last few years. So this one is fusing more of the spirituality into the science and really kind of weaving together all of these different paths that I've been on, and still speaking that scientific language and using the science that we know, but bringing in some of the deeper spiritual teachings to complement that. So that's coming out in March. Excited for that. Another round of the Light Force, which is the year-long facilitator training program that starts in June. So that's coming up, finishing up with a cohort now. And yeah, people can find me through the website, through Instagram, all the social channels. I'm out there, and yeah, just always trying to to share little bits that can inspire people and help to motivate people to just keep going and to recognize that, you know, we've got that agency, we have that opportunity to choose in every moment, and helping or trying to help people to see that that the higher choice is worth it, and that life is a beautiful thing, and we get to be here, we get to live it, and so let's live it well.
Love it, man. And you know what I really like about you, your work, and what you do? Like, I recognize it because I see other people, and there's like this, maybe it's my own judgment on other people, I don't know, but I just want to share this, is that you have this energy about you where it's not this like spiritual ego or this pretentiousness where you're like, you know, like you're humble, like you admit you're still going through stuff. I really resonate with somebody like yourself, because like, I believe that's the truth of like how we get out of this, is by people just being who they are and just being like, understanding that on the big scale, like we're all just learning. We don't know shit. Like we all just, here we are. I'm going to share with where I'm at. And like your energy that you put out there is just, it's not like this, I know, and like this like ego energy that's like drives a lot of this stuff. And sometimes like, I just notice it in certain people and certain things. And it bugs me. I'm like, man, like, it's not, I don't know. Like, but the way you do your content is like, it's not from a place of like, it's just like a really, it's a pure energy that's not coming from like, a pretentious, like ego driven place. So I just wanted to say that. And I noticed that in how you speak and how you share. And I think the world needs more of that. And especially somebody like you, who's been through so much shit and got to where you are, it'd be easy for you to be like, look, fuck, I know what's up here. Like I've been through all this. Like I know what's up. But it's true. It's someone like yourself who really could be the one that says, you want to talk about spirituality? I fucking done it. Like I know it, but you don't. And that is like what I see and I recognize in you. And I just appreciate that that's how you show up. Because there's a lot of people that haven't been through shit and feel like they act like they have the playbook to life. And it's like, maybe that's something I need to work on, why it triggers me. But it's just that kind of the world we're navigating. So thank you, bro.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Lance. It's, you know, we're all on our own path and our own path of learning. And I guess I would say, if anything, you know, the reason why I share in the way that I do now is because that ego has been so humbled so many times that it's, I really try and share from the heart and recognize how much that I have to learn on my own path. And it's like the deeper and deeper you go, the more you realize that, as you said, you know, there's so much more to learn.
Yeah.
And so it's just recognizing that, trying to meet people where they're at, recognize that everybody's perfect just as they are. We don't need to be fixed, and just trying to share what's worked for me, what's working for me in my own life, what's really resonating, and hoping that will resonate with somebody else. Because I think at the end of the day, we're all tired of being told what to do. You know, and we just want to resonate with something that feels good to us.
Yes. Yes. And yeah, absolutely. Well, brother, thank you so much for sharing everything. I know that there's so much, and I think your story, there's so many pieces of it. And I feel like you could just have a whole episode on one area of like your story. And I just think it's so valuable in the lessons, and just, you know, after doing this for 5 years, and just like, as you see people who say one thing and then they're who they are is a different thing. It's like, you practice this, but you're this. What I really admire nowadays is that people that do the thing, and it actually shows in their life and how they show up and how they, you're doing that. So thank you, brother. Like, that you got to get that story out there far and wide. And I'm looking forward to reading your book when it comes out. And yeah, man, is there anything else you want to leave the listeners with that's on your heart that you may want to share as takeaway of somebody maybe struggling with adversity right now, or just anything that you'd want to leave people with?
I think just two words, and it's keep going. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter what's happening. It's worth it to keep going, you know. And I've lost so many of my good friends along the way. And, you know, it can be so hard at times to see that there's something on the other side. And yet what is on the other side of the struggles that we're in is so incredibly beautiful that it's just so worth it to keep going, keep on the path, and know that at some point things start to get better, and it's worth doing the work to get there.
Well said. Brother, thank you so much.
It's been a blast. Thanks for having me on, Lance.
Thanks, everybody.